Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Tom Scholt, and I co-host the channel with Kevin Lindsay. For many, the words Gaia hypothesis remain mired in conceptions of a particularly fluffy brand of New Age mysticism, relying on overstretched metaphors, rather than conjuring up the rigorous, transdisciplinary, paradigm-shifting research program that it has always been. Thankfully, Bruce Clark has stepped to the forefront of the growing number of contemporary scholars treating the hypothesis with the seriousness it deserves with his deeply researched and effortlessly eloquent book, Gaian Systems, Lynn Margulies, Neo-Cybernetics, and the End of the Anthropocene, out from University of Minnesota Press in 2020. With his characteristic insight, accessibility, and sparkling turns of phrase, Clark not only lays out the fundamentals of the staggering Gaian conception of an emergent planetary-level homeostat born of complex networked couplings amongst the Earth's lithosphere, biosphere, technosphere, and atmosphere, but also guides us through the cultural formation of the theory through such diverse avenues as NASA, Stuart Brand's Whole Earth Catalog, and William Irwin Thompson's Lindisfarne Association. Mobilizing his finely honed skills in literary analysis, Clark's book illuminates the elegant contours of the theory through an exploration of Gaia discourse itself, as it evolved through academic and popular publications, as well as personal correspondence between its key players. Gaian Systems is a pioneering exploration of the dynamic and complex evolution of Gaia's many variants, with special attention to Lynn Margulies' foundational role in these developments. Delving into many issues not previously treated in accounts of Gaia, Bruce Clark describes the history of a theory that has the potential to help us survive an environmental crisis of our own making. So without any further ado, let's turn to my interview with Bruce Clark. Bruce Clark, welcome back to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. It's so great to have you here once again.
Oh, well, thanks, Tom. Nice to have an invitation back now that I've got another book out.
Yes, and another magnificent book. I have to say, I loved it every bit as much of as the last one, and in some ways, I find it even more of a kind of a stunning achievement. So, for those listeners who don't know your background, I'm going to skip the traditional first question because you have been with us before, and so I direct our listeners to our previous episode on neo-cybernetics and narrative, where they'll get the answer to that traditional question and get a bit of your background, and we'll jump right into this meaty text because, of course, we won't have enough time to go into it to the degree it fully deserves, but we want to use as much of this time as possible to squeeze as much of the Gaian juices out of this as we can. So tell us where the genesis of this book came from. You said a little bit at the end of your neo-cybernetics and narrative interview, because I knew the project had already begun by then, but tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book.
That's right. It is interesting that at the end of my last book, I have a Gaian chapter that just kind of arises from the consideration of the systems theory that's going on. But yes, I'd already been studying Gaia. I tell the story in my introduction of how I happened to meet Lynn Margulies, who's fully one half of the Gaia hypothesis along with James Locke, who's the originator of the concept. But I met Lynn. She quashed my Gaia skepticism fairly quickly, and I began. But then as I studied it, and I, you know, one of the key things for me was that Lynn was already using the vocabulary of autopoiesis to talk about Gaia, as well as talking about living systems in the fairly standard, you know, original meaning of Matron and Varela, of autopoiesis as the sort of, you know, the formal definition of the living system. So Margulis was already speaking this vocabulary, and I gradually unfolded how that came about, because and I tell that story in the chapter called The Lindisfarne Connection. So this is a meeting, a private intellectual meeting, where she meets Matron and Varela. She meets Heinz von Förster, all our sort of classic second order cyberneticists. And of interest to me had always been that Gaia was expressed as a cybernetic theory. Lovelock's mind was suffused with what we'd call first order cybernetics and control theory. And Gaia is a planetary control system for maintaining habitability of the planet. Like, that's one of the most succinct definitions you could give to what the idea of Gaia is, and I think one of the best. Mm-hmm. So it, I mean, but meeting Margulis and being caught up in her incredible energy and just inspiration really got me going. But the overlap, for instance, I'd sort of come into autopoiesis as that had developed in Heinz von Förster's milieu, and then how that had been picked up by Luhmann and taken in this entirely metabiotic direction. But it was still systems theory, and it was still a form of autopoiesis that was being argued for. And here's Margulis kind of diverging from Lovelock, who will mention autopoiesis every now and then in his published work, but he didn't really take it up. He was pretty happy with first order homeostasis or homeoresis of a system that kind of has a moving set point, but still is performing these classical self regulatory functions. So that's part of the story I tell in a book that I gradually realized needed to be focused on Margulis. Mm-hmm. As half of the Gaia story, but the half that usually wasn't told, because yes. Margulis was always entirely deferential to Lovelock with regard to the scientific, you know, priority of his having, you know, come up with the idea, and she was a helper, broadly speaking, a collaborator and someone helping him to incubate his idea. But then as time went on, she developed her own way of talking about it. Put a point on the question you asked me, I got going because I had this systems theoretical framework into which I could put all of these different matters and still have lines of connection that needed to be explored.
Right. Thank you. And yeah, it's interesting that, you know, Lynn Margulis's name does, of course, feature in the subtitle of the book. So it definitely signals that perhaps there's a bit of a corrective going on, in that her name deserves to be more front and center and not seen as some kind of Lovelock's assistant kind of thing, but rather such a critical person. And literally in the two people, you have Lovelock bringing the sort of geological and atmospheric components, and Margulis bringing the biological components, and so literally without the two of them coming together, you see the coupling literally that goes on in Gaia goes on intellectually, in a sense, from them coming from these two directions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Lovelock is generous in acknowledging that to be exactly the case, that he couldn't have fully unfolded this thing without the specialized knowledge that Lynn brought to the table. And early on, she writes a letter. I should mention real quickly the project I'm working on now as a kind of follow-up and companion volume is a totally old school scholarly volume on the scientific correspondence of James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis.
Oh, fantastic.
And Cambridge has given me a contract for that, along with my French collaborator, Sebastian Dutroy, who's in our mix. He wrote a massive dissertation in French on Lovelock. So he's the Lovelock man and I'm the Margulis man. Nice. But together we put the two sides of the correspondence together. And so now at the time this book was published, I hadn't quite I couldn't get the Lovelock estate to answer my emails.
Oh, wow.
Basically. Whereas I had the Margulis estate's permission to quote from the unpublished letters. So whenever it's something from Lovelock, there's this tiny little fair use snippet or paraphrase. But that problem was then solved in 2019. With the help of Sebastian, actually, we got through to Lovelock, and he's good, and he's basically, it's a really interesting publishing situation where basically the two estates lease us the letters for the sake of this publication while retaining copyright. But in any event, so that's why I've read all this now. I was just thinking of this letter that. Very early on, Margulis her demeanor is kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing, you know, hitching a ride with this guy who's, you know, a specialist in this whole other field. But she writes G. Evelyn Hutchinson, who's a really important ecologist of the mid 20th century, who's a mentor to Lynn. And he says, I just give Lovelock the bugs he needs to make his theories work. You know, I can tell him which methanogen would be operating here to, you know, to donate this metabolic residue to the atmosphere and so on. So,
yeah.
So her stance was always to, I mean, so there you see the deference there. She says, oh, well, I'm just helping him because when he needs a microbe, I can figure out the one he wants.
Right.
But to your basic point, that was the brilliance that Lovelock realized he needed he needed the biological side of the, I mean, because after all, the theory was that life emerging from life as a planetary phenomenon is this regulatory function. And that's what Gaia is, you know, regulating temperature, regulating salinity, regulating temperature by basically over geological time, pulling down the levels of CO2.
Right. So I think we better confront this now because you had to have your Gaian skepticism quashed. Let's give us a, I know this is impossible. Give us a quick snapshot of Gaia and what Gaia is not, because of course, in the popular imagination, right. where amongst right. certain quarters where it's been debunked and thought of as this sort of, you know, laughable sort of hippie idea of a planet with an intention and a spiritual consciousness, et cetera, which maybe isn't so crazy at the end of the day either, but nonetheless, we're talking in purely scientific terms now. So Just give us a quick overview, and then obviously we'll move through the book and how it developed as a concept.
Yeah, well, I mean, so that's, I mean, just as a cultural topic, it's, you know, it's so fascinating because of all that kind of ferment of.
Mm-hmm. Just interrupt for a second, because I think it's important to point out to the readers and listeners, this book is about Gaia discourse as much as it is about Gaia. And that's, I think, one of the unique contributions here is it's not another book restating Gaia, but you literally take us through the fermentation of that idea. And you know, not to push the metaphor too far, but, you know, cyberneticians love metaphors. The sort of autocatalytic set of Margulis and Lovelock and others through which it is created. Yeah. Sorry, right. Go ahead. I just wanted to point out that the discourse is such a big part of this.
Right. Well, I appreciate that because I'm a literate, you know, I'm not a trained scientist, and, you know, it'd be just entirely presumptuous of me to weigh in, you know, in any intensive way on the finer points of the specialized debates. But suffice to say, stepping back and looking at what Gaia wrought was a literature. and so let's call it Gaia discourse. And often, when it's Lovelock and Margulis, I mean, they really are concerned to establish the idea on a scientific foundation.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Lovelock, and the story's been told countless times, but the spin on the story I love, which I tell, is that when Lovelock was walking around the neighborhood with his neighbor William Golding, author of The Lord of the Flies, and he says, "I'm working on this theory, but I need a good four-letter word for a cybernetic control system that homeostats the environment for the optimal habitability." And this is the very early formulation. And Golding says, "Well, I'd call it Gaia." And thinking that Lovelock understood the classical provenance of the name, when in fact, this is a story Lovelock tells, he didn't know what he thought. He said gyre. Gaia in some British accent, you know, G-Y-R-E, and Gaia. And he was thinking to himself, well, that makes sense because a Gaia is a fedback system. And that's my idea of these planetary feedbacks. And so he said they're walking on, talking at complete cross purposes. And then finally Golding says, no, what I'm talking about is the goddess of the earth in classical Greek mythology. So, but Lovelock said, "Oh, that sounds good." And so, but I've always thought that story was important because at the moment that he accepts this brand, right, he has no mythological motives at all. It just had a good sound to him, but then gradually, as everything that Gaia as a name, as an idea coming out of Western, ancient history, the sort of Western mythological sensibility, I think very cannily he held on to the name, even though there was, as the sort of inside discussion develops within the sciences, they say, you know, spare us, because Gaia is now, we're getting all these woolly new age types who want something from Gaia that they think it provides, which is a notion of a sentient planet that is purposeful in some kind of spiritual way, or, you know, and at, you know, some kind of divinity is what they want to bring back to the earth. And of course, that's utterly understandable in terms of a late 20th century dynamic of in a secular world that's going to hell. I mean, just as far as, you know,
environment and,
well, the environment, yeah. Environmental, you know, alarms are already going off. Of course, back in the day, it was the nuclear threat, you know, it was just, geopolitical, brinksmanship, and then nuclear energy and nuclear power as environmentally challenging, if not, you know, a mode of snuffing life out in its own right, you know, just in one big. So, I mean, that the world Gaia enters into is the Cold War world of the, of, and then, and so the American counterculture is reading cybernetics by this point, kind of against its own mainstream, you know, emergence as control theory for guided missiles.
Yes.
The sort of progressive wave of cybernetic thinkers that, I mean, Bucky Fuller, sort of quasi cybernetic and, the original inspiration of the Whole Earth Catalog. And then Bateson's Steps to an Ecology of Mind comes out right as Stuart Brand is converting the catalog into the Co-Evolution Quarterly, which then becomes this major outlet for the Gaia hypothesis, where the audience was super eclectic and not all just, I mean, Stuart Brand's publications were, I mean, so I want to just demolish this phrase new age, because what the hell, you know, I mean, come on, to try to drop everything into that bag is just, you know, just, clouds the issues.
So, right.
But Lovelock, in fact, to edit this correspondence volume, I've been having to go back and dig up the references that they're talking about and reading it, you know, like, so even in this later, like he's rebutting, it's like a letter he sends to the journal Nature. He wants to rebut a put down of the Gaia idea that to which he took exception, and he's just makes the comment that in the Scientific Academy, kind of the nemesis of the Gaian theorists Lovelock and Margulis were the neo-Darwinians, all right, and you just have to think, you know, Richard Dawkins and the selfish gene. Yeah, in a nutshell, that's the neo-Darwinist position, genetic determinism and all that stuff. And but so he talked about the and so these were the main scientific opposition to Gaia was among the biologists, not so much the geologists, not so much the people in Lovelock's own world, but the neo-Darwinists just could not conceptually imagine that life could somehow have some agency in its own preservation. No, you know, it's just we're what that stupid phrase of Dawkins, we're just lumbering robots driven by our genes to create more genes, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that came out right at that came out in the later 70s. So right. Gaia, for many people looking to science for a more progressive vision, you know, it was sort of, well, you can go with Gaia and actually open up something like a holistic reexamination of the interrelation of life forms, or you can do this genetic reduction stuff with So, not surprisingly, most of the readers of Co-Evolution Quarterly went with Gaia.
Yeah,
Please. Later, Lovelock. Then he in this article that came to mind. He just said because of this schism, cybernetics and systems theory and whole systems thinking has been been pushed off into the new age, right? In other words, that was the way to just trash that side of real science, which say, well, this is just, you know, this is what the hippies like.
Yeah, it's some fanciful hippie dream.
So, and that's Lovelock reflecting in 1990 as being kind of caught up. But by then he's been deeply sort of celebrated and gathered in by the British Greens and the sort, you know, whatever you want to call the, I just call it the systems counterculture.
Yes, which is a fabulous name.
These people are interested in cybernetic ideas.
Yeah.
You know, and if they're interested in that, they're not woolly minded.
Not at all. Not at all.
They're not completely woolly minded.
Yeah. I have an investment in agreeing with you, but so the systems counterculture is obviously, and what an exciting group and an exciting time. And the section on that group, which of course is, you know, Maturana Varela, but it's also the Lindisfarne connection and Stuart Brand and the entire, I mean, it just made me want to jump on one of the sites that you know, auction sites and try and find a complete collection of the Coevolution Quarterly, because again, outside the mainstream of scientific peer-reviewed publication, you have these heavy hitters, not just Lovelock and Margulies, but these other heavy hitters publishing in this counterculture publication. But before we end up back around to them again, so Gaia is not a planetary consciousness deciding to homeostat the planet, right? And it's more about the coupling, the mutual coupling of all of these systems. But am I reading this correctly in that one of the key elements is that it's not just a case of life adapting itself to the planet, but that the biota is actually changing the planet, and that there is these reciprocal feedback loops through which even the geological formations of the Earth, the biota covering the Earth, beginning all the way down, of course, at the bacteria who are actually, as you say a number of times in the book, actually running the show. And then the atmosphere, and that together there are all of these feedback loops which have emerged to create an actual autopoietic entity. So an entity that's bounded on two sides, that is the shape of the globe, so to speak, that regulates itself not through a single conscious purpose, but as a kind of emergent phenomena.
Yeah.
Is that a fair overview?
That's a perfectly good overview of my presentation in the book. And so, yeah, you touched on a number of things there, but let me back it up.
Sure.
Lovelock had the thing about Lovelock, the word I use is mercurial. And Margulis just says mischievous. Mischievous. And so he would never be consistent. And this sometimes got on Margulis's stuck in her craw, because he was just willing to say, depending on the audience and what he thought that demanded, that Gaia is a single organism. Gaia is and as an organism, then so that there's a singular, and that was kind of the problem, that if you just call Gaia an organism, even though it's a metaphor, the metaphor, there too much is wrong about that metaphor. And one of the main problems is then you get a kind of singularity vision, and that's just one step to like one mind, one world, the oneness of it all.
And the global. Gaia,
and that's exactly the wrong direction to get a feel for what you were just describing, which is the multiplicity of Gaia, which is some of which has been fathomed, but my sense is that there's, you know, the unfolding of what we call feedback loops, just to have a reasonable category of thinking about the system dynamics of all these imbricated interrelated subsystems and leading to meta systems, and of which, of course, Gaia is the final iteration. And I mean, so there's this tension in the concept between the operational multiplicity and then the sort of the idea that, you know, that's also comes along with the system concept, is that, at the final iteration, you do get some, you get the closure that is proper to the conception of an autopoietic system. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that system then is, you know, that's the whole enchilada, but is still, you know, vastly mysterious just in all the sub programs.
Right. So you've pointed to this tension between the holistic view and the more systemic functional differentiation. And it seems like Margulis provided a lot of the important corrective to when Lovelock would, in a sense, be a little sloppy in that direction. Yeah.
You know, it's really a complicated thing because Margulis insisted on autopoiesis, although she was extending the classical, Matron and Varela version of autopoiesis. So one way in which she was, okay, but the thing about Margulis was she tended to think of Gaia as the sum of the biota, okay, which you could still theorize kind of as, you know, as proper to an autopoietic description. Whereas I think Lovelock was right that every now and then he'd say, well, Lynn, we have to remember it's a coupled system. It's not just the biota at the planetary level turning into a, you know, a superorganism, but it's that sum of the biota as coupled to the geology that has both its own dynamics, but yet has this reciprocal formative dynamic with the biota, and as you were bringing out earlier. So that's exactly right, in that the classical story was just life was along for the ride on this active rock that would just throw, you know, the next volcano at it, and life would adapt to the new conditions. And so that picture has been completely, and that's just a completely superannuated, you know, old picture now, because life alters. I mean, just as a process that involves the uptake of energy and material nutrients, and then the production of metabolic, you know, and then whatever that metabolism yields and then excretes back into the environment. you run that process over 3.5 billion years and you get a completely, a world that has been processed through the coupling of life to its environment over all those eons. Mm-hmm. So Lovelock has a really beautiful phrase for this. He says, we live in the breath and bones of our ancestors. Mm-hmm. And so the breath is the atmosphere, of course, but the bones are the rocks. So many of, later Gaian theories that I very much I think are totally on the right track. This is again something Margulis pushed ahead with while Lovelock was doing other things. But that water, the retention of water on the planet, is in fact a Gaian outcome, an outcome of Gaian regulation. And if that's the case, then you need, if Gaia maintains, in other words, Venus and Mars both used to have water, but the water's all gone for different reasons, and all you've got is these super saturated CO2 atmospheres on these desiccated planets, but they did have water. And just like we had water from that massive late bombardment that brought all the water down, according to the latest cosmological theories, but we've kept our water. Why? Well, so this, I mean, the Gaian explanation is that the, you know, life processes emerged out of this coupling of life to its environment that there's this kind of threshold at the top of the boundary, right? If we think of Gaia as two-sided, which I go into in the later part of the book. I mean, so the top is this sort of diffuse part of the atmosphere, and that's where the water, I mean, water would just, you know, in the upper atmosphere would just be hit by solar energy and then just kind of deliquesce out of the planet. But there are these processes that kind of freeze the water out and precipitate it back and so forth. And because we've retained our water, we've got plate tectonics that, in fact, it's the oceans that lubricate plate tectonics and allow that tectonic activity, which in itself was just a theory that had been completely or at least broadly rejected when it was first proposed. And then the evidence came in, and now we realize now just exactly how these dynamics. So these are, of course, abiotic. I mean, in other words, the heat and the, you know, the churning over of the core of the planet up towards, so these are, and now that, but there's a lower boundary of Gaia that is also very porous but that's been another side to recent science discovery, just how far down life is able to penetrate out of the crust into the mantle be bound up in these sort of deep hidden processes. But where do you, Margulis just, made the statement that Gaia's boundaries are blurred, but I wouldn't want to read that in an entirely postmodern way. That the point is there are boundaries.
Yeah.
As opposed to no boundaries, just a diffuse,
What you pointed out, what you pointed out about the lower boundary, you know, sort of say the earthward or the planetward boundary, which was fascinating to me, is this thing you talk about how, because one of the many marvelous things that this book does is it not only, you know, gives us this insight into Gaia itself and then Gaian discourse and then the cultural forces at work, Gaia as a cultural phenomenon, etc., but it also helps clarify and go deeper into systemic, you know, just ideas and insights about cybernetics and systems. So when you think about, you know, where does one draw a boundary and even ideas of boundary critique and boundary placement, the fact that science, in a sense, keeps extending where that lower boundary is. We think, okay, well, this is, we've reached the place where the interactions are not as strong now. That's the boundary. And then more and more geological science keeps linking further down, and that the interactions continue to be strong even further down, in a sense of what is the lower reach of the actual autopoietic system. So that was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I just think it makes all the difference. This has been part of my campaign to insist that we need these systems theory parameters in a more broadly critical theoretical effort to, you know, to grapple with the world that we confront, the rhetoric of boundary dissolution only takes you so far and is in many ways a rhetoric and not an ontology.
Right.
But if you're committed to the system's description, then you put a stop to that. You say, and then the problematic is, given this boundedness that allows for the autonomous operation of whatever autopoietic formation you're putting at the center of your attention. Nevertheless, it's not an autistic phenomenon. In other words, the problematic is how do these sort of internal autonomies gather together into a higher level ensembles?
Yeah. The Luhmann fundamentals, system environment differentiation, I find is interesting here. And Luhmann doesn't play as prominent a role in this book as in your previous one, but it's definitely present in that sense. And these differentiated systems inside larger systems and one system is inside an environment. What is that system's environment is
right. Is
a larger system in that.
Right. I thought the thing is, you know, that, in many ways, although Lovelock doesn't talk the autopoietic talk, he conceptually, his moves are congruent, because he's the one insisting we've got a coupled system here. And so it's actually Luhmann's, transposition of autopoiesis out of the strictly biotic domain, which allowed me to theorize what I call metabotic Gaia here. But the trickiness here is that whereas in the Luhmannian scheme, you've got structural coupling of the psychic and the social system, all right, which are operating in terms of a virtual mode of distinction processing, right, mm-hmm. to create formations within the medium of meaning that move back and forth between minds and communication. Okay, so that's the Luhmann scheme. The theory that I developed and then just kind of put out there to see if anyone wants to grab is that from Margulis you get the autopoiesis, which, you know, and so that's great, you know, but it's from Lovelock then that you get the insistence on the differentiation between the biotic and the abiotic, okay, which mm-hmm. then Gaia is a coupled system, the autopoiesis of which is driven from the biotic operation, but which then binds itself to these structural formations, these material energetic structural formations that are bound up in these, in this melange of system processes.
Yeah.
so that the metabiotic here doesn't move into the virtual or in other words, it doesn't move into meaning or spirit. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying metabiotic Gaia is the way it gets a mind, but rather, no, it's the way that it gets the complex closure at the planetary level that then operates in terms of what the biota contribute, okay, which is all the maintenance and the reproduction of life as the, you know, kind of bottom line of living mm-hmm. processes.
Right. What we haven't confronted yet, of course, is the technosphere. So can you say a little bit about now how that's its role inside Gaia?
So the technosphere, and here, Margulis has a very distinct way of working Gaia in relation to the technosphere in this kind of lost paper published in the Whole Earth Review, which was the continuation of the Coevolution Quarterly, Gaia and the Evolution of Machines. but I think they just get it co-written with Dorian Sagan. But I think they, so the basic choice, if you look at the large debate about the technosphere, what it kind of comes down to is, it is the technosphere autonomous in its own right? Or is it going to achieve a kind of cybernetic autonomy understood in sort of first order terms, that the technosphere will essentially, and even Lovelock in his most recent book sees the AIs coming along to take over for us. At which point the Anthropocene will become the Novocene. But when he follows that idea out all the way, it's the end of Gaia, because eventually the robots will figure out how to do it on their own without having to sort of preserve the biotic environment out of which they emerge. So, Margulis, and so to me, that's a very dim, grim, that's a grim vision as far as I'm concerned of futurity, where Margulis made the point that if you look at evolution very deeply, you see this constant dynamic by which living systems, living organisms, repurpose their in particular repurpose the materials that they put back into the environment. So the example is calcium. So calcium's a poison within living tissue, so it gets excreted as part of the self-preservative dynamic of the microbial life back in the time, but eventually you have all this ambient calcium in the environment, and then it's pulled back into the evolving system as the hard parts. Mm-hmm. So that's where you get your bones and your teeth and your shells, right? So that's a kind of tech. So let's think of that as a model of what technology is. It's this constant reincorporation and reorganizing of the environment. So if we think of the technosphere just at that level as sort of building up of structures, given the affordances of the environment, then you see the machinic phylum
right.
and of course that's a metaphor. I just want to leave as a metaphor, right? But so, and here again, in fact, Luhmann's scheme is handy to me because I see. If you want to, in my diagram of this, where machines as non-autopoietic systems have their place is as mediating structures between minds, between consciousness and communication, okay? Mm. Between psychic and social systems. That's what, and so the technosphere to me in its Gaian conceptualization is this non-autopoietic extrusion out of your two autopoietic registers of biotic life in the first place, and then the virtual autopoietic processes of minds and societies. So what you get there is a diversity of system types that cluster into this. And so Gaia now comprehends bodies, minds, communication dynamics, technological emergence. But in terms of a kind of a planetary boundary, okay, which is which is fundamentally Gaian, okay, and not, in other words, that as near as I can see is going to have to remain the ground of possibility of technological emergence.
Right.
And fantasies to the contrary are just that. And now you get people like my friend David Grinspoon, cosmological thinkers, interested in biosignatures and this is the astrobiological thing that I was doing at the end of writing this book. But one of the great questions in this field is, where are all the intelligent worlds, right? The great silence. What, the universe should be teeming with technological civilizations. And if so, we should be able to detect them. So how come we can't? Just last night, we're watching Starman with Bridges and Karen Allen.
Classic.
It's really a great movie.
Yeah.
But it picks up on that, we sent this probe out and it hit some intelligent world and they sent the Starman down to leave his seed. Just the point on this idea is that, what if the most profound, sort of endpoint of evolution is not a technosphere that then detaches itself from its ground of origin in a biotic world, but rather one that merges its technosphere with its Gaian foundation in this sort of superstructure or further unfolding of those systemic possibilities, but to the point at which it lacks any sort of, in other words, the technology goes underground.
Are we at the level of a planetary? Are we at the level of a planetary cyborg at that point?
I suppose we could be if you've got your org in place.
Yeah,
I mean that's it can't just be a cybe.
Right,
it has to be a cyborg.
Exactly. So it just was reminding me of sort of the Donna Haraway stuff that comes sort of at the beginning of the book.
She was picking up, she was using her cyborg idea to think about Lovelock's articulation of Gaia and makes, there's definitely something to be said for that way of looking at it.
Yeah. One of the critical things about the technosphere, though, it seems to be, is that, and the problems that it clearly presents for us if it's not handled well, is that Gaia relies on loops of recycling. And if our technology only burns stuff but does not return something to the cycle that can be reused, then there's a problem. And Gaia is not trying to maintain humans. It's maintaining life, and it will go on without us, right? I mean, so the bacteria will run the show regardless, and as you say, the set point can change, right? The set point doesn't have to be one that can sustain human autopoiesis necessarily, but there's some great stuff in the later chapters where you talk about some other Gaian inquiries and this idea of the human sort of mastery of combustion. And but there's something about not participating. If our technology cannot participate in the recycling cycle, then it cannot become sort of a functioning part of Gaia in that sort of way, in that way that's that will sustain our life.
Yeah, that's how I express it. I mean, that's how I see it, really. That what Gaia has had the time to bring forth is and the microbes accomplished this billions of years ago, but and then it just became part of the foundation of the emergence of the later life forms was a recycling regime where no organism can subsist on its own waste, but it can subsist very well on another organism's waste mm-hmm. that's sufficiently different from it, that its waste becomes nutrients for it, okay? Mm-hmm. And so the biosphere is self-recycling, you know, and that would be another way to think about its autopoiesis the biosphere here, as a synonym for Gaia, right, and not just strictly the biosphere, but the biosphere understood as structurally coupled all the way down to yeah. its geology, and so that yeah. if the technosphere could repair its own metabolic rifts. So that's a phrase I got out of Mackenzie Wark talking about Kim Stanley Robinson. But the rift is that when we break up the pieces of natural affordances like fossil fuels, which are a perfectly Gaian phenomenon as long as they're there in the ground, you know, which is part of the geology that is left in the wake of life. They would be sort of planetarily recycled in their time, but now we're just kind of pulling them out and just pumping them out as waste, into atmospheric sinks and oceanic sinks that are saturated and can't take it anymore. So my thought has always been, well, if these AIs are so smart, but really they don't have any goals, let's have them, let's just put them on the job of recycling the technosphere so that it arrives at its own Gaian closure.
Mm.
And then we're good to go as a planetary civilization.
Mm.
At least more likely to maintain the viability of our home, which has got to be what we have to strive for.
Yeah. And there's other fascinating stuff about the other option, of course, is that we leave, right? And Gaia, this is the cradle of Gaia, but we don't stay in our cradle forever, right? Is the phrase that comes up from the Russian cosmist whose name is escaping me at the moment. But
yeah, Tsiolkovsky.
Yeah. And so, but the both in science, as a professor of literature, you do bring in some science fiction, which is we get some Neuromancer and we get some, again, of Kim Stanley Robinson's Aurora. But the ideas about leaving the planet, that if you can't take Gaia with you, there's a problem, right? Yeah. And that these enclosures that were imagined by NASA and other people, there isn't the sufficient mass and the sufficient amount of time that a mini Gaia is very difficult to pull off, right? I mean,
it's an unsolved problem. Yeah. So the way Margulis saw it was kind of, she was happy to think of sending life off from this planet, but that was a challenge for our ability to understand how to recreate a Gaian milieu that could effectively recycle itself. So but then she thought of life. Her sense of life was kind of driven by a vision of biotic potential, which is just that life left to itself, life will just burst and proliferate. And then it always hits a limit, whether it's just an ecological limit of a nutrient that it needs is unavailable but she thought, there's no reason why our life couldn't burst out of our home and go off. But it would have to have solved this problem first. Mm-hmm. And a problem that, generally speaking, was always like when O'Neill came up with his space colony ideas, that was happening right around the time that Gaia was coming out. So it's there in the same pages of Coevolution Quarterly. So there's a kind of automatic coupling of the topic. But so Margulis was happy to think that this is a way of promoting Gaian science in the NASA milieu, because really you can't fudge this thing when push comes to shove. Mm-hmm. And so Aurora, this wonderful recent novel by Kim Stanley Robinson, imagines a massive space vehicle that's trying to ferry life 10 light years away to a very, you know, relatively close planet. And it's got this sort of ecologically diverse closed world, right, of with all these different microbiomes. So it's really like a biosphere 2 sent off to another star. But eventually the ecology just starts to go bad after about 150 years. And because that final problem of remediating metabolic rifts hasn't really been solved. And so try what they may to tweak their artificial environment that they're inside in the ship that's like 10 kilometers long hitting all these problems where like just salt, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
It's salt is
gotta eat a lot of salt, everybody.
Too much salt. You know, how do we, just something as simple as that. But again, you know, fresh water or ocean water, you got your halophiles and your halophobes, and human beings can only take so much.
I haven't had a chance to read that novel yet, but it sounds like, I mean, Robinson's obviously fantastic. And I think that sounds like an absolutely marvelous piece of quote unquote hard sci-fi in terms of really taking those Gaian issues, taking them on.
I had a chance to, I met him when I went out to UC Davis to give a talk and had a chance to have a conversation with him and then follow up with some emails, but which I asked if I make the statement that, you know, that your sort of the message of this failure that you depict in the novel to master the ecological issues is a Gaian observation, and he assured me that he would not be unhappy with that.
Right. And he was looking at the O'Neill diagrams that are reproduced in your book, yeah?
That was William Gibson, a new romancer.
In terms of I'm forgetting the name of the environments now, but yeah, where yeah.
The different habitats that
habitats,
Gibson has a new romancer. There's Freeside.
Freeside, that's the name that was escaping me.
Place, yeah. And then there's Zion, which is where the Rastafari builders who don't want to go back down the gravity hole.
And it has more biological diversity, it seems.
Right.
And
I mean, it just, what you can see that Gibson has been. I'm just assuming he was reading the Coevolution Quarterly airing of these issues, although he could have found it in other sources. But that was the popular venue where these issues were debated. And Margulis saw to it that paper that she co-wrote with a bunch of ecological colleagues. I think they were centered at the Woods Hole lab there in Massachusetts, but it's called Ecological Considerations for Space Colonies. And it was exactly what O'Neill, as an engineer the architecture of these orbital environments was just kind of pushing off to the side as, well, you know, it, how hard can it be once we've actually created these massive orbital habitats to stick some trees in? And
right. It's a little more complicated
get
than
some
that.
Ferns, you know, and get our recycling atmosphere going.
Yeah. Wow. So we've taken up a lot of your time. You've been most generous with your time. And again, as usual, I won't say we've scratched the surface. I think that's the wrong metaphor. We've been able to take a look at one layer, because we actually spent most of our time really talking about Gaia itself and less about the incredible social systems that produced it. There's the wonderful stuff about the systems counterculture, which I'm glad we got a chance to touch on briefly, but all of the characters and, you know, and Lindisfarne. I got to say, I mean, I was aware of William Irwin Thompson. I was more aware of Evan Thompson, his son's writings, because of his connection with Varela. The quotations from Thompson are breathtaking. I mean, this, not only the insight, but the wordsmithing. I realized that Thompson, not a name that comes up at cybernetics conferences, or, you know, but man, we are all missing something by not reading more William Irwin Thompson. Just extraordinary.
Yeah, well, that's a whole different set of issues there. But that was a gift from Lynn Margulis, because just very soon after we made connection, and then I spent a couple of weeks at her lab, and then we really got to know each other. And then year after that was 2007, and she said, "I'm going to be in Santa Fe at they're reviving the Lindisfarne Fellows meetings after like a 10-year hiatus." And since I just live 5 hours away from Santa Fe in West Texas, I said, "Well, can you bring a guest?" And she said, "Sure." So I got to see Lindisfarne in action before it, I think, pretty finished up. And then Bill Thompson just died last year.
Yeah.
And his stuff is out there, but it's, for various reasons, it never hit the mainstream, and it's, you have to kind of go looking for it.
Well, you've inspired me to hunt it down, because I was just salivating for more of it after what the things you've been able to serve up in the book and the way you frame them. So again, just another one of the amazing things. And, you know, I love that you're still pulling new things out of Neuromancer, because everyone talks about cyberspace with Neuromancer, and for you to take a Gaian gloss on Neuromancer, again, another sort of fascinating way to encounter an old text. Well, again, I mean, I wish we had another 3 hours, because, again, we've talked about Gaia, and then there's all the other social formations around Gaia, and then there's the further Gaian inquiries around planetary immunology. And so, folks, you just have to read the book. It's just that simple. And you already gave us a taste of what you're working on next, which is this book of letters, which we're super excited to follow up on. And of course, another excuse to have you on the podcast that I will not let you escape. So once again, thank you so much, Bruce, for being here and sharing your vast knowledge and your insight with us. And I can't wait for the next book and our next conversation.
Well, I really enjoyed this, and I super appreciate your opening. I mean, we need a chance to stretch out, to mm-hmm. open up this all the goodies.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we hit multiple layers. So I was really happy with that. But in any event, Tom, next time you call, I'll be ready to do it again.
Excellent. Okay. Thanks, Bruce. We'll see you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.